Welcome back to the podcast, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you are tuned into Film Literature and the New World Order, that podcast series where we examine different books and movies every single month, looking for pieces of predictive programming as well as potentially tales that can help us to understand and even process this world that we're living in a better or more fruitful way. And on that note, we are going to be examining this month the tale of Narcissus and Goldmund by Hermann Hesse, the German Swiss author, and of course this was first published in German in 1930. And I was delighted and tickled to note one of the commenters in the previous Film Literature New World Order episode speculating, or at least bringing up the idea of, why on earth was this particular novel chosen for this month's conversation? And please, by all means, please do speculate and share your speculations in the comment section as to the next month's edition of this series every month. I'm always interested to hear that. But this month, I did not pick this myself. In fact, I myself am curious as to precisely why we are discussing this book. Today, this book was picked by our guest, our old friend Dr. Tjeerd Endringa of the University of Groningen, and hopefully you will already be familiar with Tjeerd, if from nothing else than from our very interesting conversations, such as interview 776 in the Corbett Report archives, Tjeerd Endringa on geopolitics and cognition, or our recent conversation on conspiracy and falsifiability. But of course, you will also hopefully know him as the gracious and generous host of my recent trip to Groningen, where I talked about Gladio B, and a good friend besides all that. Dr. Tjeerd Endringa, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
It is a pleasure to be talking with you once again. How is dear sleepy Groningen today?
I wouldn't say it's so sleepy, actually. No, it's pretty good. It's always a vibrant, very nice place. Lots of students.
Absolutely, yes.
Producing that vibrancy.
And on that note, I should also direct listeners' attention to the interview where we had that roundtable with some of your very interesting and engaged students that I was delighted to meet when I was there in Groningen. A very interesting conversation. I quite enjoyed it anyway. So I hope people will check that out.
The students definitely did it as well.
Excellent. Well, I hope they miss me intensely.
I'm sure they do.
All right. Well, that's not exactly what we're going to be talking about today, but maybe that has some part to play in what we're going to talk about today. Of course, we are talking about Narcissus and Goldmund, so hopefully everyone will be on board and will have read the book in preparation for this conversation and will have their own ideas of why we might be talking about it. So why don't I cut directly to the chase and highlight the passage from the book that I think best represents why I imagine you are getting us to read this book today. And I am, of course, basing this on my knowledge of yourself and your research interests and your interests in general and geopoliticsandcognition.com, which I don't believe we've mentioned yet, but which I hope people in the audience will be familiar with. And if not, they should go there and read about geopolitics and cognition and the interesting intersection of those subjects. But given all of that, and given our previous conversation where we talked about the different hemispheres of our brain and the way they process our experience differently and the idea of authority versus agency, I'm going to assume that this following passage was one of the crucial passages for what you wanted us to be thinking about today, so you can tell me if I'm right or wrong. This is on page, it looks like 246 or so of the Kindle edition of this book. Quote, "It was shameless how life made fun of one. It was a joke, a cause for weeping. Either one lived and let one's senses play, drank full at the primitive mother's breast, which brought great bliss but was no protection against death. Then one lived like a mushroom in the forest, colorful today and rotten tomorrow. Or else one put up a defense, imprisoned oneself for work, and tried to build a monument to the fleeting passage of life. Then one renounced life, was nothing but a tool. One enlisted in the service of that which endured, but one dried up in the process and lost one's freedom, scope, lust for life. That's what had happened to Master Nicholas. All existence seemed to be based on duality, on contrast. Either one was a man or one was a woman, either a wanderer or a sedentary burgher, either a thinking person or a feeling person. No one could breathe in at the same time as he breathed out, be a man as well as a woman, experience freedom as well as order, combine instinct and mind. One always had to pay for one with the for the one with the loss of the other, and one thing was always just as important and desirable as the other. Perhaps women had it easier in this respect. Nature had created them in such a way that desire bore its fruit automatically, that the bliss of love became a child. For a man, eternal longing replaced this simple fertility. Was the god who had created everything in this manner an evil god? Was he hostile? Did he laugh ironically at his own creation? No, he could not be evil. He had created the heart and the roebuck, fish and birds, forests, flowers, the seasons. But the split ran through his entire creation. Perhaps it had not turned out right, or was incomplete. Or did God intend this lack, this longing in human life, for a special purpose? Was this perhaps the seed of the enemy of original sin? But why should this longing and this lack be sinful? Did not all that was beautiful and holy, all that man created and gave back to God as a sacrifice of thanks, spring from this very lack, from this longing? I'll end the passage there, but I mean, let me just put that out on the table. I believe this is really the central issue of the book and probably why we're examining it today. Please let me know if I'm right or wrong.
It's bullseye. Yeah, a very, very good, selected this little part. Indeed, what I think that the book is about two ways of engaging with the world, and they are explained in this particular passage. Yeah, so one way is really participating in the world, and one way is trying to control it or try to control a small part of it. And you can lose yourself in participating in the whole world, which what Goldmund is doing, or you can actually create a little small world and control it and make it a beautiful, nice, stable place, what Narcissus is doing. And actually, here it is as an opposition. But what I think, it's our task to actually integrate both.
Now that's also what I assumed you were going to the direction you were going to be leading us in. But it is interesting that this book, especially in that passage, and even in the title and in the way the entire narrative is framed, really does present it as a type of opposition and deals with it, I think, in that passage quite directly. The lack and the longing that we all have because one or another of those modes predominates in our psyche. We are either the thinker or the doer, the artist or the logician. And although I certainly do agree and believe that we can be and all are to some extent a synthesis of the two, there is usually a predominance of one over the other in us. And there's something about that longing for the other side of experience that we all, I'm sure, can relate to and that forms an integral part of our psyche. I think that is interesting that that is so deeply embedded in this book. And it seems to me that the logic of the book, the narrative of the book, is driving us towards the conclusion that we should become happy in what we are. If we are the thinker or if we are the doer, we should be content in that and aware that we will never be that other side of experience. But I'm assuming that you're going to tell us that the synthesis is actually what we should be aiming for?
That indeed is exactly what I would personally think. And so what we see here is two unfulfilled lives, basically. It's Goldmund going into the world, experiencing an awful lot of things, but creating actually very little. And what he creates as an artist, and typically what he is doing it. No, let's go first to the other one, to Narcissus, who is very, very good in reading everything that other people have produced, from Aristotle, Plato, all the mystics of Catholicism, etc. And he is integrating that in his mind, using it in a very logical way. He is definitely, in the beginning, the master of Goldmund, because he is actually seeing what is happening in Goldmund. He becomes the abbot. And then is ruling in a very wise, very friendly way over the monastery. But he's only engaged in a very small part of the world. And what is happening at the end of the book is that Goldmund, with all his experience and all the fortunes and misfortunes of his life, he is creating a few works of art that he is actually bringing into the monastery. And so he is bringing the world, in some sense, in an artistic way, into the monastery. And what I would say is that the combination of the two is actually the thing that is really important. And mm-hmm. and so we have two extremes longing for each other in some sense. But basically, they are two facets of all of us.
Yes, and again, I wouldn't dispute that. To me, it seems self-evident that no one is completely the 100% logical thinker, and no one is 100% the imaginary visionary artist doer. There is always an admixture of the two. It's just a question of which one predominates, and I'm sure in everyone that I can think of or that I have ever, you know, gotten to know on a deep level, I would say that it's obvious that one side of that does predominate. But
I would agree with that. Every one of us has a starting point, and that starting point is either on one side or the other side. But if you look at what, for example, Maslow is saying about self-actualization and what they call self-realization somewhere here. Actually, there is a small passage about that. And that is very much that is the realization of your full potential. And the realization of your full potential is in part engaging with the world and in part thinking about the world and learning from that world and learning from everything in the world, whether via experience or via knowledge.
Right, yes. Yes, it's very much, I think, about that process of reflecting on and detaching ourselves to try to find a structure in the world, but then obviously engaging with the world to get that knowledge and experience. So obviously those two sides of it make up anyone that could potentially be called a well-balanced individual or a well-rounded individual. But you point out an interesting part of this, which is that in the beginning of the narrative, it is very clear that Narcissus is the sort of predominant, the leader of this relationship and the one that Goldman obviously looks up to and respects and treats as the authority figure in a very real sense. And by the very end of this narrative, it completely inverts, and I think does so in a very interesting way, where at the near the very, very end, we actually get into the head of Narcissus thinking and reflecting
finally.
About, yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and until that happened, I hadn't really reflected on it, but the whole narrative had really been from Goldman's perspective, really. And then suddenly we get into Narcissus' head, and we understand finally at the end of the novel that this revered figure who had been seemed sort of totemic in a way in Goldman's understanding, that this was, you know, a man who had his life sort of sorted and ordered and was a peaceful in his mind. We understand the sort of longings and desires and gaps and that exist in Narcissus just as they exist in Goldman. So there is kind of an inversion of that relationship. And of course, at the very, very end, a very powerful concluding passage that almost shows that Goldman is, in a way, completely the dominant in that relationship, that he is the one who finally truly understands life and death in a way that Narcissus presumably never can, never will.
I think that's a very important point. And why can't Narcissus, why can't he understand it? And the reason for that is that his knowledge and his wisdom is completely abstracted. And it is knowledge that is detached from the world. And he's saying that a number of times, that he is about abstractions, about generalizations and things like that. And therefore, because he detached himself from the world, something as normal as dying is something that is scary, that is completely undiscovered terrain that is not part of his mind anymore. And that is, I think, the reason why Goldman's last remark really burns in his mind.
I would read that differently, because I would think that Narcissus, I tend to believe at face value that he is the abbot of this prior or whatever, the cloister, and truly does believe in in God and the afterlife and all of that, and that death doesn't concern him in that way because of that, because he has that logical framework for understanding death. But that there is something about death that he will never quite understand because he never experiences things. Let's examine a passage that where Goldman and Narcissus are talking towards the end of the book about this duality, this split. And Narcissus says, "Listen, the thinker tries to determine and to represent the nature of the world through logic. He knows that reason and its tool, logic, are incomplete, the way an intelligent artist knows full well that his brushes or chisels will never be able to express perfectly the radiant nature of an angel or a saint. Still, they both try, the thinker as well as the artist, each in his way. They cannot and may not do otherwise. Because when a man tries to realize himself through the gifts with which nature has endowed him, he does the best and only meaningful thing he can do. That's why, in former days, I often said to you, don't try to imitate the thinker or the ascetic man, but be yourself. Try to realize yourself." So again, this is a quote from Narcissus talking to Goldman. To me, I read that, when I read this passage and in the context of the book, I read it unproblematically as the message of the book. Be yourself. Try to realize yourself and be, if not content with that. I mean, obviously, the lack and the desire is still there, but content in the knowledge that that is your place in this world, that you are this person, and that the best you can do is to do what you have with what you have. But perhaps I read that naively. Again, this is a quotation from Narcissus. Maybe Hesse is putting these words into Narcissus' mouth to show us that Narcissus himself doesn't quite understand the real value of what it means to be a person in this world, experiencing both thinker and artist. I mean, is Narcissus deluded here, that he doesn't even understand quite
nature? I see it as two facets of the same that are in constant dialogue with each other. And Goldman is saying one thing, and Narcissus is saying the other thing. And this is happening basically in our minds. And we have two people in this book who are doing this as two different people, but it is actually two ways of engaging with the world that are constantly interacting within us. So I just see it as the story of one half of our brain. It's completely valid, your interpretation. I would say it's a superficial, the best superficial interpretation of the book, and is what Hesse explicitly put in the book. Mm. But what one level higher, seeing this as two aspects of humanity or of any individual, mm-hmm. which also there are also some indications in the book that this is actually the case. Goldman is saying that at a certain moment. Then you have a higher level of interpretation, I would say.
I think you're right about that. I think that clearly, I mean, the narrative is such that we can read it as, in a way, this, I mean, as I said at the beginning, I think everyone has, to some extent, Narcissus and Goldman in their personality. So we can read this as kind of a dialogue of an individual within an individual. So in that sense, I'm trying to think if Narcissus is the type of logical thinker who would come up with the idea that, you know, don't try to imitate the thinker or the ascetic man, but be yourself, try to realize yourself. What would be the opposite of that? What would Goldman say in contrast to that?
Well, when you read that initial paragraph, or the two initial paragraphs, you skipped a paragraph.
Yes, I did.
And I marked that one. And it's something like, life made sense only if one achieved both. Well, maybe you should read it, actually. Do you have it here?
Life made sense only if one achieved both, only if it was not split by this brittle alternative, to create without sacrificing one's senses for it, to live without renouncing the nobility of creating. Was that impossible?
Deal. That is so the thing that you skipped,
yes.
Actually the main message for me.
No, very interesting. And I didn't even consciously do that. I was just going by what I had originally highlighted when I read it the first time. But it's interesting I did not highlight that passage.
No, and I put an exclamation mark in front of it.
Very interesting. Yes, I am completely with you that this is an integral part of what this book is trying to get us to look at. I mean, obviously, yeah, it's about the nature of this duality and what can be done with it. And Narcissus's answer seems to be, at least what he's saying, is that you have to be what you are and you can't change that. But
I think this is something like the typical Western interpretation that you can hear pretty much everywhere. And Goldman is saying this. This is Goldman thinking when he was, I think, in jail or so, just before he was captured. Hmm. So Goldman actually is the one who has the deeper truth. Hmm. But he has more difficulty in articulating it.
Yes, which of course makes sense given that, you know, he thinks in images. It's difficult for him to put things in logical constructs.
Yeah, but well, he is intelligent enough. But that's not a problem.
Yes.
But he is not of the extreme logical ability and inclination as Narcissus.
Right, and I think this gestures towards a number of things, but also, I mean, even the ability to put things into words, to put experience into words, is something that someone who is a Narcissus type will be able to do more fluidly and easily than a Goldman type.
But a Goldman type is able to put an experience into a work of art.
Yes, exactly. But interestingly, he is denied the sort of the real aspiration of his entire life, which is to put his mother's image into a work of art. And
why? Mm. And I would say that is only a possibility for the really integrated mind.
Hmm.
But that's yes. That now I'm...
Well, you're right, because at the end of the narrative, Goldman is a broken man, and he says if he had the strength in his hands, he would carve that image, but yes, he doesn't anymore. But he's happy enough for that because it is his mother, you know, squeezing the life from his heart. I mean, it's just such a really fascinating way of phrasing it, and the ending is very powerful on a number of levels. But that is very telling, isn't it, that he becomes the broken man who, in his brokenness, realizes he can finally do that work, but he physically can't do it.
No. And here is something about authority. So an authority is someone who can shape a habitat. In some sense, Narcissus is the authority. He is, he's only an authority in his own cloister. And on a small world, and as long as the world is not too invading, he is in complete control, and he can be wise and create a really nice part of the world. And then we have Goldman, who never really created something, except for a few works of art, but who is completely involved in the world, who knows the world extremely well from birth to death and everything in between. And so if you combine those two, then you have an entity, a person, who is able to really shape the world in a way that allows everything to blossom, and not only the small part, the intellectual part in a remote part of the world, the cloister, but much more pervasively. And when Goldman, he can accept death at a certain moment. But go now one step further. Suppose we have indeed an integration of the two persons, who is really creating part of the world and who is looking back at whatever has been created. That person then can, I think, accept death, because all around the fruits of his or her life are visible as a co-created world.
Mm-hmm.
So as a person you might die, but your legacy is and it is very much around you. And I would say that gives an extreme peace of mind.
Yes. Yes, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. I mean, clearly Goldman, let's start phrasing this in the terms that people would expect, I think, from the Corbett Report. I mean, if we're talking about these issues of authority and agency and self-sufficiency and things of this nature, obviously dealing with such things as economic collapse or what have you, clearly the Goldman type is the one who's going to survive more easily than the Narcissist type, because Narcissist has made his little nest in the cloister and clearly rules that that nest with some authority. But in the event that that delicate balance is disturbed, Narcissist becomes a fish out of water and unable to cope, whereas Goldman can cope in pretty much any circumstance that nature throws at him. So
Maybe. But the Narcissist type is also the type who is going to control, when attacked, control the bigger world. So the Narcissist type might also be the one who is actually, well, running the big corporations of the world and a military-industrial complex and so, and shaping the world in such a way that he or she can control it.
Hmm.
Yeah, and then
yes,
the
Goldman right.
are much more the people living in that world,
right.
More or less created
who can adapt
for them
to the world.
Yes, and adapt to the world.
Right.
And
rather than shape
it.
The world. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, shape it to a certain extent, but not structurally like a Narcissist type would do. I think you're right about that. I think that's a very good insight. But to my mind, so again, I come back to this. To my mind, this is why I always continue to advocate that rather than centralized government and centralized authority and centralized structures of power, which I think is fundamentally what, I don't know, I don't want to say we, but what I am fighting against in so many different ways, in so many different aspects, economically, financially, and governmentally, and all of this. As opposed to that, the way that we best combat that is through decentralized and uncoordinated leaderless resistance, where everyone is sort of an individual acting in their own way, because it is, I still come back to this, there are, in my mind, there are the Narcissist types who have that structure and the ability to think structurally and logically and can shape the sort of greater systemic conditions of the world, and there are the Goldman types who are better at adapting and showing others how to adapt to various circumstances and shaping sort of the miniature world around them in a way that will help to see them through. And to my mind, it's that's the beauty of this leaderless, decentralized, uncoordinated resistance, is that there will be different types who will approach these problems from different ways. And it's in that collection of different people coming together out of necessity, if nothing else, that we will find the real answers and the way forward. In my conception, it's never going to be one person who's going to encapsulate all of that. And I think that it still strikes me as idealistic, utopian to think that we're all going to become the Narcissist and Goldman, the combined entity, and somehow face the world in that way. But please convince me that I'm wrong on that.
Well, I would, in general terms, I'm completely in agreement. But there's one thing that I think we disagree a little bit about. That's the interpretation about what it means actually to be a combination of Goldman and Narcissus. So if we want to have that leaderless, the decentralized world, then we need actually people who are able to co-create a world in which it is good to live. And that co-creation process that entails basically that everyone can contribute to, with his or her actions, to a world in which it is ever better to live. And what is happening now is that people, in many cases, are not able to do that. So they are looking for a central authority, and they are giving their agency away to that central authority, and basically when they are really unhappy with that central authority, then they might choose another one, but it's still a central authority. So what is really needed is that people don't need that central authority anymore, and therefore they have to internalize the role of authority. They have to internalize, they have to the ability to actually co-create a world themselves. And with an enormous diversity of different ways, like you said, and with all kinds of different approaches, but in all cases they have to choose actions that in general are beneficial for the whole. And choosing those actions is something that is extremely difficult and that you have to learn, and for which I think we need both approaches. We need both that participation, engagement of the world characteristic of Goldman and the logical, abstractive abilities of Narcissus. And you need to acquire wisdom by engaging from the world, learning from other people, thinking about your own thoughts, adapting your own thoughts, adopting better practices all the time, and so gradually come up with better and better structures to co-create.
Hmm. Yeah, there seems to be a sort of hidden utilitarian premise in your argument there that I think perhaps bears questioning. But before we get too lost in the narcissist side of this conversation, I fear we might be losing the Goldmans in the audience. We are talking about this very structurally and logically, but I think we need to put this in concrete terms. What does this actually look like for people who are living their current realities in whatever situation they may find themselves, their 9-to-5 cubicle jobs or their blue collar worker jobs or whatever it may be, listening to this conversation, wondering how this relates to their daily experience, let alone the New World Order broadly defined. What does this actually look like when we start seeing people who are able to exert this ability to co-create their world around them?
I would basically say that, well, everyone is doing it to some degree already. If you have friends, then you're co-creating together a situation that is nice for you among friends. So if you're able to give that more and more substance and to change that the things that you can do among friends, also in your work environment, also in your living environment. And to gradually take more and more roles of the government over and distribute them among yourself, and therefore make centralized authority gradually irrelevant. That would think is the normal course of action.
I find myself again and again coming down to simply the level of. To put it at its most basic level, the food. I mean, the ability to grow one's own food, or at least source
That's
one's
a good
own
starting
food.
Point.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. I mean, to fulfill if we're going to look at Maslow's pyramid of needs or hierarchy of needs or whatever, then obviously we have to start there. You have to be able to provide food and shelter for yourself and your family in a way that will, you know, I mean that you can be the authority, and obviously. The development of civilization in the 21st century context has taken away so much of that authority from the average person that it seems to me that the sort of ground level fundamental thing that we all have to do is to start finding ways to detach ourselves from that system and to become more co-creators of our own existence when it comes to our food and living environment. I wonder, what then is the next stage after that point? Because I find myself coming back again and again to say that the geopolitics and all of these things that are going on are these grand systems that it seems like there is no way for the average person out there to insert themselves into that, at least not at the point where we're still dependent on that economic and geopolitical reality for our daily bread.
Well, I mean, well, of course, you know, we have our own vegetable farm, and so we already start there, and that is really, really great, and it is a very, very active way of contributing. But the hierarchy of needs of Maslow has another very important low level need that has to be satisfied, and that is safety, and. And then the geopolitics comes really strongly in it. I just listened to Daniela Genzer in the link that you had sent in the members video.
In the subscriber newsletter, a link to the Mind Renewed's conversation, Julian Charles's conversation with Dr. Daniel Genzer on Operation Gladio.
Exactly, that one. And he had a number of very simple ways of phrasing how to interpret NATO and all kinds of covert types of things Basically, yeah, we should think about it and think about what is the source of our fears. And one of the things that I think is extremely important, and what he was sort of saying, is that the fear is in many cases an illusion. And it's just a fabrication, and something like that is fairly easy to change. And it, of course, we have to. The world is more or less created by those people that want us to be fearful. But still, we have all kinds of ways to influence that. And especially now in this situation with Ukraine and all the other things going on, the story of the geopolitical story that is being presented to us is rather flimsy, I would say.
Yes. You know, I mean, it's interesting. You phrased that in such a way that I'm sure I've had this thought many, many different times in many different ways, but it's just occurred to me in a different way. And I suppose we could take our metaphor from a different piece of fiction, The Wizard of Oz. It seems like that the idea behind alternative media generally could be that pulling back of the curtain to expose the wizard as just the little man pulling the buttons and pulling the levers and pushing the buttons, not really something to be feared at all. And that in and of itself is a fundamental aspect of the importance of unseating that authority that is ruling over us and putting ourselves in that position of authority, realizing that all of these machinations to make us fearful is nothing other than tricks and deceptions. Once, I mean, just the realization of that is in and of itself freeing in many ways.
Yeah. But I'm always surprised that when I say that when you have a big military in the United States, their first priority is enemies. How can they have enough enemies to sustain their own defense budget? And I'm always, well, people may ignore me or so, but I never get someone who is saying, well, this is completely ludicrous. And people I usually, hey, well, that's a nice way of putting it, and they might ignore me, but everyone kind of agrees. And so then I wouldn't be surprised that we are pretty close to tipping points. At least I hope.
I certainly hope so too. And hopefully we're all doing our part to push that tipping point a little bit further ahead. Further to us, closer to us, you know what I mean. Yes, I would like to think so. And again, trying to take this back down to the personal level, I mean, obviously on the big geopolitical scale, we look at, you know, the United States or NATO or what have you, creating enemies and in order to justify their own militaristic existence. And again, looking at this in terms of even our personal relationships and what kind of understanding we can take away from that. Does this relate to the individual in the way that perhaps in our own lives we create enemies, as it were, in order to preserve bits of ourself or to extend bits of ourself that perhaps are egotistically pleasing, but not necessarily fulfilling of ourselves as individuals? Am I being too abstract here? I'm sure you know what I mean, that people who sometimes create their own problems in order to have some sort of way to interact with others in the world.
Yeah, but maybe that I have to think about this. But we need to motivate ourselves. And in a world in which there is... we don't have the basic motivations anymore, like food and shelter and things like that. That's all taken care of. We're going for a different type of motivation. And I think many of us spent an awful lot of time before television or so. And then after a while, they discovered that it was not nourishing. It was not delivering anything. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if people start to realize that whatever is given to them by the big corporations and the current authorities is not at all nourishing. And then we come a little bit in that direction of, okay, maybe those influences are actually a little bit like the influences of an enemy. And then we can use that that sense of there is an enemy, actually in a productive way.
Hmm.
Is that kind of an answer or kind of a response?
Yes, I would accept that as an answer. That's very interesting. But again, I keep coming back to this idea that it sounds like what you're proposing. To me, the idea of us in some way becoming Narcissus and Goldman together and realizing both sides of our potentiality sounds to me like the completed individual, the completed man, the completed woman.
I can actually give it easily substance. If you look at the definitions of an educated mind, and there is someone called Perry who wrote a book about it that I don't have it here, but we can link to it probably. And basically what he is saying, the mark of an educated mind is the ability to examine your own thoughts, to examine the data that you use, to examine the suppositions that you're using. And that is the logic part. Yeah. So basically you use the Narcissus contribution to think about everything you learn from the world, the Goldman, from your interaction with the world. And then you... If you learn how to examine your own thoughts and to improve the quality of your thoughts, to gradually adopt better thought practices, better data, etc., then you are developing yourself very quickly, because every thought is going to be better than the previous thought. And then I think we have the integrated individual who is both engaged in the world and able to think about his own thoughts, and that is already known, and it leads to a phenomenon that we all know, and that is wisdom, the ability to create to contribute to a world in which it is good to live in. So I think this is a very normal process. It is only the abnormality is pulling the two sides away from each other.
Is the scientific method itself a sort of civilization level version of what this we're talking about in terms of individuals, insofar as the scientific method is to go out into the world and conduct the experiments and gather the data, and then to, you know, use our logic and structural analysis to find out what that means and how we connect it together?
Well, yeah, yes, I would say absolutely yes, but it is not exclusively for science. And in all fairness, I don't think that science is doing a very good job at this. And so in science, we ended up in a situation in which everyone is studying one little part of the world, like Narcissus is controlling his monastery and nothing else. Well, we come up with all kinds of theories that pertain only to that little part. And we have great, great, great difficulty in actually discovering that two theories derived from two different domains of science are actually perspectives on exactly the same. And just two different ways of looking to a deeper truth. And for me, that is what science actually should be. And we are now writing a paper that is called Cognition from Life. It's not out yet. Hopefully it will be accepted by the reviewers. But that is going in that direction in which we basically say, if you look at the definition of life, what can we already say about the all of psychology? And that is the story that we tell is actually very much associated with the book that we're discussing today.
Accepted by the reviewers? Cheered, you should be co-creating your own environment and not accepting the authority of others.
Yeah, okay. But I also agree to play the game of science. And now and again, I try put a little bit of a wrench in the system. And
you're doing an admirable job at that. I'm very much looking forward to that paper. And please do let me know when it is available, and I will let the audience know, because I mean, that's just obviously the heart of what we're talking about. All right, well, just to draw this conversation to some sort of conclusion in the place where we began, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. I quoted the passage that I quoted and skipped over a couple of paragraphs. You've dropped my attention to one more paragraph, but there is still one paragraph that in the middle that we still have not read. So let's read that paragraph right now. Again, okay. This is Goldman thinking about this nature of this duality. And he had just said, as we quoted earlier, life made sense only if one achieved both, only if it was not split by this brittle alternative. To create without sacrificing one's senses for it, to live without renouncing the nobility of creating, was that impossible? And then the next paragraph, perhaps there were people for whom this was possible. Perhaps there were husbands and heads of families who did not lose their sensuality by being faithful. Perhaps there were people who, though settled, did not have hearts dried up by lack of freedom and lack of risk. Perhaps he had never met one. So yeah. The question cheered, have you ever met one?
I think I do. I did to some degree, yes. The interesting thing is that they are not so very conspicuous. Hmm. They are the people who quietly create a small world for themselves and for others, and really contribute to a better world. And in many cases, they are a little bit overwhelmed by the rest of the world that has no such abilities. But I wouldn't be surprised if we are actually on our path that more and more people are becoming able to do this. And it might actually become a norm at some point in time.
Hmm.
And then, actually, when you're thinking about the Middle Ages, this is the 14th century where this is playing, and now, I would say, actually, we made a lot of progress. It's not all progress, but I don't think that the quality of living for pretty much everyone 600 years ago was as good as it is now. And it yes. takes quite an effort yes. of our leaders to screw that process up.
Hmm. No, that's quite true. Well, you have obviously given us a ton of food for thought with this book and with this conversation, but
Sorry.
In the interest of satisfying my own curiosity, I am probably of the opinion that I think that the answer to the question I'm about to pose would probably be best served by all of us thinking about this in our own way, but I will ask you directly to, again, to satisfy my own curiosity. What, then, do you recommend as a method or a way of trying to develop that other side of our personality that does not predominate? If one is more narcissist than Goldman or one more Goldman than narcissist, how does one bring out and foster that other side?
Play, the word play. Play. I think that as an educator, I'm thinking, how can I teach students the most? And I think when they are in a playful mode, engaged with kind of serious stuff, they learn the most. And they have a lot of fun at the same time. So I would say play. Playing, you can only play when you engage with the world and when you are reflecting a little bit on what is working, what is not working, so if you make that play a little bit serious, a little bit critical on yourself, a little bit of metacognition, thinking about your own playing, that I think that's a very simple advice, but it might be really powerful.
It resonates a lot with me, and I certainly see what you're saying. But again, I think everyone has to find their own way to negotiate this, and it probably depends so much on everyone's own individual experience, appropriately enough. All right. Well, again, as I say, we've had quite an interesting conversation and quite a very interesting book. And let me thank you very much for commending this book and bringing it to my attention, because it is a book that I probably would never have read in my entire life if it had not been put in front of me in such a way. And I'm glad that it was, because it strikes me that I I really do believe myself to be more narcissist than Goldmund. And yet, I do believe I do have the Goldmund within me, and it brings to my mind the sort of earlier incarnation of my life in which I was convinced I was going to be a novelist. and reading this book really made me think once again about that aspiration and that sort of side of me that has not been lost, but certainly is not at the forefront anymore. And reading this book in and of itself, if only because it is such a beautifully written book, has really inspired me to want to write something fictional again. So I don't know if anything will come of that, but at any rate, I thank you for bringing this to our attention and for bringing this whole conversation to my attention. It's the kind of thing I love to think about, and I hope the audience does too.
I hope so.
Well, we'll leave it there. Dr. Sheard Andringa, once again, let's direct people to geopoliticsandcognition.com, where obviously you have a lot more resources about the types of topics we're talking about today. Are there any other resources?
I should update it more.
Yes, you should.
I will probably do it in summer, but definitely not now.
Yes. Well, fair enough. You are a busy man in other respects besides. So are there any other resources you'd like to direct people to?
No, that's it.
Okay, well, we'll leave it there, and there will be, of course, show notes with links to various of the things that we have mentioned in this conversation. Dr. Sheard Andringa, always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
No problem.
All right, friends, that brings to a close another edition of this Film Literature in the New World Order podcast. And before we go, as always, let's take a moment just to acknowledge some of the feedback that we got from last month's conversation. In fact, there was a lot of feedback from last month's conversation. You'll remember that last month we were talking to Richard Andrew Grove about Philip Drew, Administrator by Edward Mandel House. And we got a lot of different comments from that, not only on the website, but also through email. Just going briefly through some of the comments that we received on the website itself, we had, for example, Steve Kelly 911 saying, "Great discussion. I think the connections of Mandel House really get right to the crux of who pulls the strings of the Federal Reserve. The City of London and the merchant banking dynasties of the British Empire may have lost the U.S. in the Revolutionary War, but just over 100 years later, they got it back solidly in 1913. Wilson was probably a bigger puppet than Nixon." And he goes on to recommend Treasure Islands by Nicholas Shackson, so I hope people will check that out. David Brown says, "Outstanding discussion, gentlemen. This is perhaps your best work to date, in my opinion." Philip says, "I can't imagine two people better people to discuss this book, and I have some minor points that James and Richard didn't mention," and he goes on, for example, to talk about the quote from Mazzini at the beginning of the book, noting that Mazzini was an early promoter of a united Europe, and he says, "I wonder what House had to say about Mazzini in his private papers. I suppose that quoting Mazzini was a little more subtle than quoting Machiavelli." We had Torben Bo Hansen leaving a comment, "Very interesting indeed. House was advisor to President Woodrow Wilson, but who advised House?" And for those interested, more information on Edward Mandel House can be found in the book The Controversy of Zion by Douglas Reed, Chapter 29, The Ambition of Mr. House, and there's a link there in that comment. Bile Jones says, "Scott Horden, late of anti-war radio fame, did a series of interviews channeling Philip Drew about a decade ago." John D. Jasper writes, "I've just listened to the audiobook of Philip Drew Administrator at LibriVox, and I'm amazed that anybody ever read this book to the end. It should come with a warning to keep a sick bucket handy at all times. I'd love to think that it was indeed intended as a spoof of the powerful men of that era who worked hard to mold their societies according to their visions, regardless of what anyone else may have wanted. Yet I suspect that this was Colonel House's own vision of how the USA should be reformed if he only had the opportunity. Well done on producing a very interesting podcast." And Steve Kelly 911 adds, "Maybe the bad literary quality was part of the agenda in putting something out there without making it popular enough to be the mainstream. Or he was a pathetic author. Either one is possible." I know which one is my preference when it comes to those options. Kush350 writes, "From the Small World Report, I was employed by the CRI and SP Railroad that jointly ran the Trinity and Brazos Valley Railway with CNS parent Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad. And that TBV was, of course, co-founded by Edward Mandel House. And Larry also wrote that he was disappointed that Richard Grove forgot to mention the best nonfiction book about, among other crucial matters, House, Rose L. Martin's Fabian Freeway, High Road to Socialism in the USA, 1884 to 1966, which shows that House is not only a member of the Rhodes Conspiracy, but also a Fabian socialist. And the Fabians met regularly with the Rhodes imperialists, and they formed a dining club expressly for that purpose. Finally, we also had that comment in from Philip, which I mentioned during today's conversation. Why Narcissus and Goldman? Having just reread it, I am truly stumped as to why James selected this modern classic for FLNWO, perhaps merely to atone for Philip Drew. That would be reason enough. I can't wait to find out. Well, I hope that this podcast at least met your expectations, or hopefully exceeded them, Philip. So thank you for that. And if anyone cares to speculate on next month's film or book each month, by all means do so. Use the comment section to do so. Of course, members can log into the website and leave their feedback directly there on the post. And the link to last month's conversation will be in this month's conversation in case you need a link to it. All right, having said all of that, it is time now to assign your homework for next month. So next month, on the third Monday of the month, as always, we are going to be discussing a film. And this time a film that stars Clint Eastwood. And although Clint Eastwood is very much in the news and in the alternative media information space at this current time for his latest movie, his latest directorial effort, American Sniper, glorifying the Navy SEAL sniper Chris Kyle, and that's an interesting story, and there's much to be said about it, but a lot of it has been said in the alt media from what I've seen, so we're going to look at a very, 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 very different Clint Eastwood movie. This one, not from 2015, but from 1989, and not directed by Clint Eastwood, but starring Clint Eastwood. I am referring to Pink Cadillac. Yes, indeed. A very, very, very different choice for next month's conversation. So I hope you'll join me there, and I hope you'll watch the film in advance. As always, this is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Thanking you so much for joining me for this podcast, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again very soon.